This is Economics for Entrepreneurs, the podcast where we apply the principles of economics to help you start, grow, and manage your business. Here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Today we want to add a little bit more to your thinking about the resources you assemble for your business and the relationship between those resources and your success. We define success as the creation of value. The primary value that matters most is the value that your customer or consumer experiences. A consequence of that is the creation of market value for you and your enterprise. In the value-centric model that we discussed with Per Bylund, and we illustrated in the free value-centric process infographic, we defined how value resides entirely in the consumer or customer experience. Your firm's resources, consequently, must be a precise reflection of the customer's desired experience. Your resources must be selected, combined, refined, arranged, rearranged, tuned, maintained, and managed with the singular purpose of facilitating a superb customer experience. The drive to assemble a unique structure of customer value-tuned resources presents many challenges. How exactly can resources be unique? You might use the same raw materials as other firms, or the same ingredients, the same Windows laptops, and the same Salesforce.com software and QuickBooks accounting. Your office may not be very distinctive. Your cars and pickup trucks might be the same as those of other firms. You're hiring from the same labor pool. But if you take the customer-first approach, you can quickly identify the areas of uniqueness where advantage lies. It could be in customer service, if the experience customers receive from other firms is less than they expect. In the service industry, this can be a people-based resource, and all people are unique, and they can be given unique training. It could be in marketing, when the communication of the value experience and the management of customer expectations is an important part of the value itself. It could be in design and style. If you write software as part of your product or service, there is scope for unique coding or unique combinations of functions and APIs. Or it could be in operational excellence, as Jeremy Vester explained, where your precision creates value both for your upstream input suppliers, because they're selling into a no-waste environment for their benefit, and your downstream customers who get the input they want from you with better-than-average reliability and trustworthiness. Often there are combinations of services that are unique, even though each one is broadly or separately available. Geography and location are sources of uniqueness. Opening hours can be. Any kind of personalization or customization of service approaches uniqueness. So, for example, when you respond to an RFP, the personalization of the delivery and the precise responsiveness to the conditions of the bid can all be unique or at least highly differentiated. Any service that embraces creativity, like marketing or PR, includes a direct route to uniqueness. There are other issues and challenges, of course. Is there greater value to the customer in vertical integration or in more narrowly focused specialization? Does the customer find greater value in a systems integrator or an irreplaceable component contributor? What's the best role of outsourced resources in your service delivery? Let's see if we can think this through in a systemic way. With us today is Professor Stephen Phelan. He is the Distinguished Professor of Entrepreneurship at Fayetteville State University in North Carolina, where he teaches MBA students strategic entrepreneurship, entrepreneurial strategy and finance, managerial economics, business policy and strategy, and new venture creation. Steve, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We're trying to help entrepreneurs succeed, and one way that economists like you help them think through the routes to marketplace success is in thinking about resources, the resources that entrepreneurs bring to bear to deliver value to the customer. And you're an expert in this field of analysis. We appreciate you being here. You've written extensively on it. Maybe we'll start with a quick history of resource-based economic thinking and how it's distinctive or different or useful.
Well, in the field of strategic management, with which I'm most familiar, the term resource-based view was first used by Werner Feld in 1984, but popularized by Jay Barney in a seminal paper in 1991. And what they were trying to do is to turn the view around that advantage or competitive advantage was related to products, and to look at the drivers of those products, the resources within the firm that led to competitive advantage. The approach itself was a reaction to the work of Michael Porter, who came out of an industrial organization tradition and antitrust, who had basically argued that the secret to competitive advantage was to create barriers to competition in various different ways. And your listeners are probably familiar with barriers to entry and supplier power and buyer power in the market. And so over time, management theorists and economists are getting worried about the ethical and antitrust concerns of advocating for anti-competition, essentially. And so the resource-based view turns this around and basically says a competitive advantage arises from having better resources than your competition, or alternatively using those resources in better ways. And over time, eventually making that advantage difficult to copy as well. So you can get a temporary competitive advantage if you have better resources or use common resources in better ways. And then you can get a sustainable competitive advantage by making that set of resources difficult to copy.
Okay. A couple of questions about that, Steve. Those dates that you cite, 1984 and 1991, it's a while ago. Is the resource-based view, is it dated or is it up to date? Is it evolving? What's the current state?
I would say it's been evolving since that time. Where the field went after the 90s was to go into something called dynamic capabilities and to look at how resources could be changed over time. So recognizing that we live in a very competitive marketplace, particularly with global competition. Some even use the term hyper-competitive markets. And so the key to maintaining advantage, some thought, was actually to be able to update that advantage over time, find ways to create new resources, new capabilities, new sources of competitive advantage, not just protect the ones that you've got. So that's certainly where the field has been moving over time, away from basic ideas.
And one more question here. We talk about competitive advantage in this resource-based view. Mm-hmm. We've been encouraging our entrepreneurs to think less about competition and more about uniqueness, mm-hmm. and that the success in the marketplace is less about competitive advantage, comparing yourself with a competitor, than it is with perfect alignment with customer needs, which is just comparing yourself with what the customer's ideal is. So can we say unique about resources, or the search for uniqueness? Is that an okay way to think about it?
Well, certainly people who have unique resources tend to enjoy superior performance if those resources are something that are valued by the customers. So I always use the example of Michael Jordan playing basketball. You know, he was very unique at what he did, Tiger Woods in golf and so forth. And so there was something there, the package that was brought together that gave them an edge on the playing field and led to endorsements and led to success in their chosen field. And so in that sense, you can think about unique, but you don't actually have to be 100% unique to outperform competitors. You just have to be differentially better. So we tend to talk about scarce resources rather than unique resources being important. So it's a sliding scale, if you want. So it may just be that you have a slightly superior location, which gives you an advantage and leads to more customers, and you're in a location that customers value more than somebody else in the market.
Yeah, I think uniqueness is something that's an ideal goal. It may not be achieved, although in the branding world, you try and make your brand unique. Tide is just laundry detergent, but Right. Hey, there's only one Tide.
Right. So it's nice if you can be the one, of course. Yeah.
Yep. So let's get some definitions here. When you use the word resources, when you're thinking about the firm, what are you including? What's included in resources?
The best way I remember it is to use an acronym called PROFIT. PROFIT for the different types of resources. So if you think profit, we're talking physical resources, so things you can touch, buildings, equipment, reputational resources, so the brand name, as you mentioned, the culture of your firm. Think about organizational resources, which are the systems and processes within the firm. We think about financial resources for the F. If you've got a lot of capital or access to capital, that's helpful. Intellectual resources are the I, and that's a growing part of this field, that knowledge can be a source of advantage for a firm. And finally, technological resources, so patents and any other uses of technology that you might have. So there's also a divide between tangible and intangible resources. So the tangible resources being typically the physical resources, the financial resources, things you can see and touch, and intangible resources being those things that you can't necessarily see or touch, culture, processes, so forth.
That's quite a list. So it seems like a challenge to organize around that. So one of the things we'll try and do today is see if we can help entrepreneurs identify which of those resources are the ones they should focus on in this search for uniqueness or competitive advantage, depending on their market. But let's take an example. It's always handy to take an example. Let's say I'm a seller on Amazon.com. I've designed a unique product, a special beverage cup. Mm-hmm. I get it manufactured in China. It's sold on Amazon. It's delivered by FBA, which is the fulfillment by Amazon process. What are my resources in that as opposed to those of Alibaba or Amazon or any of my partners?
So one of the things when you're manufacturing something or coming up with a new product like that is that the ability to design the new product, to see the opening in the market, so to speak, that there is a demand for something like that, to put the idea on paper, to bring it to realization, that capability to take your knowledge and your ability to assemble resources throughout that value chain or that ecosystem that you've just described is actually a resource in itself. And so making those judgment calls, deciding which supplier that you're going to use, which manufacturer, how you're going to ship it, how you're going to insure it, how you're going to market it, all of those things are intellectual resources, if you like, or human resources. So they definitely fall under the purview of this theory.
Okay. So it might be a lot of the O in profit, organizational, organizing the, mm-hmm. the ecosystem, but there's a little bit of financial in there, making sure that the finances work and so on. Okay, I get it. And then the other word you come across in this literature, Steve, is capabilities. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between resources and capabilities?
So very simply, a capability is just how you use your resource or deploy your resource. So it's the processes, it's the action of using the resources to deliver services to your customers. So that's the simple definition. And Barney originally in his 1991 article included capabilities within the definition of resources, but later authors have seen fit to separate those things out. And there's been a focus on the separation of the stock of resources versus the actual doing of things over time with those resources.
So if capabilities are resources applied, I like that that definition. It sounds to me like that's a place where talent could come in. Some people might have greater talents for applying the same resources than others. So how do you think about talents in this formula?
So talent itself is a resource and what you know, who you know, what you know how to do. So I like to talk about know what, know how, know who. Your ability to assemble talent is itself a talent, if you think of it that way. So people have talked about these meta capabilities, first order capabilities, the ability to do something with resources is a resource. So in that sense, talent is very important. And when I made that division earlier between tangible and intangible resources, a lot of authors in this area think that the intangible resources are the ones that are most important because they're the ones that are most difficult to copy. So not knowing how something works within an organization, not understanding what the secret sauce is often the key to success.
Yeah. I remember a book called The Knowing Doing Gap. Mm-hmm. Which took exactly that principle that knowing what, having some knowledge, doesn't necessarily mean you know how to apply it. And that's the difference between successful companies that and unsuccessful companies that might have the same knowledge. So that's capabilities, it sounds like.
And probably between professors and billionaires, right?
Right. Now you have more knowledge. So let's start thinking about application, and the filter or step or lens you could look through is what you mentioned earlier, I think, where you said that all value comes from scarcity relative to demand, and value is what we're trying to create. So how does the entrepreneur utilize that principle of scarcity when thinking about organizing resources?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. Originally, Barney made this distinction between value and scarcity, and in some later work, my co-author and I pointed out that value and scarcity are two sides of the same coin. And so this is very important for entrepreneurs to think about, because anything that can be easily copied is not going to lead to a profit stream in the future. So you've got to think about what you're going to do that's going to be different from everybody else. And so just to give you an example of what people are asking for, a lot of your listeners may be familiar with the business model canvas. And there's another canvas type document called the Lean Canvas that explicitly asks people about what is your unfair advantage? What is your secret sauce? Guy Kawasaki has these 10 slides that he suggests that people use in the pitch. And one of those slides is to talk about your magic or your secret sauce. And so to me, that's the scarcity element. What are you doing different than everybody else? If anyone's watched Shark Tank, you often hear Mr. Wonderful ask the question, why couldn't I do this if I just threw $1 million at a team and told them to go and copy what you're doing? And often presenters don't have an answer to that because anyone could copy what they're doing. And so coming up with that kernel that you're going to have that edge over everyone else is extremely important for entrepreneurs. So I had an example in a class I taught many years ago when I was at the University of Texas at Dallas, where I had a student team come up with a Redbox DVD dispenser. And I'm sure everyone's familiar with Redbox. Mm-hmm. But they had designed and invented this thing 3 years before Redbox actually went to market. So they predated Redbox. And they had a business plan and they had blueprints. And when they presented to a VC group that I brought in, they said this was the 10th one they'd seen that month. And so it's in the air. People were thinking about DVD vending. So why was Redbox the winner in the market? Why were they the ones that became the market leader? And often I have to think it's because they had connections in Hollywood. They were able to get the supply chain worked out, get the right price for their videos, and also to get the distribution channels. And if you recall, Redbox was originally distributed in grocery stores and outside McDonald's and so forth. So I'm thinking their team probably had connections on both ends of that chain there, which made them a winning proposition. So that's an example. There's a lot of people having similar ideas, and you really need to think about what's going to put you over the top.
Yeah, and that points to this talent of orchestrating mm-hmm. all the different parts of the system mm-hmm. In a way that produces a uniquely desirable result and value for the consumer. And one of the words in Barney, I think, is inimitability. So you said that the VCs have seen 10 of these ideas when your team turned up. How does the entrepreneur look at his or her own idea and say, this is inimitable? How do you get to that point?
Well, one is I think you ask a lot of people and you present your idea to a lot of friends that aren't afraid to give you candid feedback and tell you whether what you've got is truly unique or difficult to copy. Barney, when he originally came up with the idea of how do you make something difficult to copy, basically had three answers to that. One was unique historical conditions. So why can't we copy being Harvard University? Because, you know, we're no longer in 1600s and that's already been done. So Harvard's brand is very difficult to copy. It's impossible to copy, actually, because of historical accidents. So that's out for entrepreneurs. We're not going to try and duplicate that. But the other two are causal ambiguity, which is a really strange word, which basically means that the competitors can't see how to copy what you're doing. They can't see inside the black box, so to speak. So the more difficult that you make it for people to see what's going on behind the scenes, the more difficult it's going to be to copy. And similarly, your competitors are going to try and hire your own people away from you. And if they don't understand what it is that gave you the advantage, then you're really onto something. So the classic example there is GE with Jack Welch at the helm, where they outperformed the stock market for almost two decades. And companies left, right, and center would hire GE executives to tell them about what it is that he was doing, and yet no one was able to successfully duplicate that.
Right.
And that's a great example of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so social complexity is related to that, and it's doing a socially complex process with a lot of moving parts.
Right. One of our guests earlier, Jeremy Vester, talked about one capability that was highly differentiating and value creating, and that's operational excellence, which isn't always in the innovation textbooks, and maybe people don't think about it enough, but just being able to guarantee to your customers and even your upstream suppliers that you will operate with excellence, you'll be on time, you'll be on budget, the products will be perfectly cut in his case and perfectly packaged, and this trustworthiness and integrity and differentiation in that. So could we say operational excellence is a capability?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a bundle of capabilities of things that you do really well. There was another concept that came out a while ago called core competence, which essentially referred to a bundle of capabilities that a firm had, and certainly operational excellence could be a core competence. And it's a classic example of something that's actually really, really difficult to do. And it sounds easy, it sounds trivial almost, or mundane. But the older I get, the more I realize in a complex organization, it's actually very difficult to deliver a high quality, consistent result. And most organizations don't achieve it.
Yeah. And maybe don't think about it enough. That was my thought.
Well, I think they think about it, but it's actually really hard to do. And so if you look at net promoter scores, everyone's not perfect on their net promoter scores. Mm-hmm. And it's an example in point that everyone isn't pleasing their customers. And
right.
They'd like
then
to.
Then you said, so we've got operational excellence, and then that doesn't last necessarily, because you said at the beginning that dynamic capability is important. The ability to change quickly in response to changing consumer needs or changing environmental mm-hmm. conditions or changing competition. Mm-hmm. Is that a capability itself, or is that another bundle of capabilities?
I would say it's a dynamic capabilities, a whole set of capabilities around detecting the need for change, actually making the change occur, making it stick once you've made the change. But it certainly starts with detecting that there's a need for change, and, or sensing, as some people have called it. It's not just the CEO or the owner of the firm, the entrepreneur, having to sense that there's something going on, but you've also got to convey that sense to people within your organization and create a sense of urgency that something has to be done. And then you actually, here's that word again, orchestrate the change and make sure all the different parts of the organization are aligned with the new direction that you want to go in. And that itself is not a trivial skill. And so organizations that are able to do that consistently will get an advantage from that.
You used an interesting word there, Steve, sensing. Mm-hmm. As a resource or a capability, or maybe it's a talent, sensing what the Austrians like to call it, the uneasiness of customers, or sensing changes in the marketplace. We've used a term before called empathic diagnosis, which is using empathy to figure out what it is that customers need, or what they're missing, or what would help them a little bit. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about similar things here? Is empathy part of sensing, or how do you think about those elements?
Any of that of, any way that you can gather new information, new insight into what customers are seeking or even may not even be aware of themselves. So we talk about needs being not always expressible by customers. So latent needs is the name that people give to that. And so even being able to sense latent needs through some empathetic process or any process really that enables you to do that. So Steve Jobs is a classic example there of, you know, he charged ahead with new designs and brand new to the world technologies like the iPad, where he was just relying on his intuition, right? Not necessarily listening to what customers want or and giving it to them, but actually trying to anticipate what was going to work. And that's, you know, some would describe him as a one-of-a-kind entrepreneur.
Yeah, we're always tempted to think of that as the deductive process in Misesian praxeology, Steve, that it takes a talent, but you can observe customers' behavior and maybe listen to them. And even if the need is not articulated, you can still deduce, as Steve Jobs did, that they'll want an iPod in their future. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, and some even use the word abduction, which is to try and deduce from limited numbers of examples. You don't necessarily have to sample huge numbers to do that.
And it's there's creativity in that. I mean, some people are more creative than others, but it's still a deductive or abductive process.
Yeah, and so that creative spark, along with that drive for perfection that Steve Jobs had, was a very potent combination.
So let's jump to another resource, and that's people.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a service economy now. Many services are delivered by people. They might be in the front line, or they might be behind the scenes. It's human intervention either way. And should we think of the resource of the people that we hire and on our team as a resource, and that attracting them and training them and retaining them is a capability that can lead to competitive advantage?
I think the answer is emphatically yes. And of course, we all use the term human resources, so that's a big giveaway that humans are resources. But the way that people are used in organizations varies widely. And so I often use the example from Harvey Liebenstein, who wrote about something called X inefficiency, where two factories in Egypt were using exactly the same machinery that was imported from the US and drawing from an almost identical workforce from very similar villages close to each other. But one of these factories was twice as productive as the other. And so identical physical resources, identical human resources, and yet a productivity difference. And so the reason is because of how those physical and human resources were coordinated together and, more importantly, motivated as well. So in that sense, the organizational systems are important, leadership's important, culture becomes important in order to get the best out of the resources that you have at hand, which includes human resources. So people talk about procedural justice, for example, being important in the way that you deal with issues in your organization that generate signals to workers on how to behave. All of that becomes incredibly important. So my father used to say a champion team will always beat a team of champions. And I think that goes right to the heart of this issue in the resource-based view. It's not just about having the best resources that you can possibly get. It's not having an unlimited salary cap in the NFL. That won't guarantee you winning a championship. It's the way that you blend those elements together that may be as important, if not more important.
Yeah. Is that management rather than entrepreneurship, Steve, making the team succeed?
You know, it's interesting. For me, entrepreneurship is always about insight and seeing arbitrage opportunities and ways to make things better. So in you're being entrepreneurial every time you try a new system, a new way of organizing, a new way of aligning the resources under your control. So I would see all of that as entrepreneurial activity.
Yeah. And then you use the term human resources. Sometimes the term is human capital, right, which I find that attractive, because then the entrepreneur is looking at all of their capital stock, if you like. That includes the people that they've hired, as well as the technology that they have and the machines that they have and so on. Is it legitimate for an entrepreneur to think about people as human capital?
I think you can use the term resource, capital, or asset fairly interchangeably in this sense. as you said, as being the stock of the organization. But ultimately, it's how you deploy that stockage or capital or assets at your control that determine how you're going to perform in the market.
You mentioned culture as one of these resources, and it used to be very fashionable to talk about corporate culture and team culture and the culture of Amazon and the culture of Google and so on. And I'm not sure it's quite so popular now, but is it really a plannable and differentiating resource? Can I create a culture or shape a culture or manage a culture?
I think you absolutely can. In my experience, I've been involved with several startup organizations. I've been involved in leadership roles in my current organization. And I think there are some decision points that you have when you're in that entrepreneurial role or leadership role where you decide what sort of organization you're going to have. So one example is when there's a problem, do you solve it straight away or do you just wait for it to build up to a crisis? Something as simple as that, of just telling yourself, I'm going to resolve things sooner rather than later, or saying that you're going to have product releases on a timetable rather than just when they're available. So Intel is an example of this, where they gave themselves a timetable to release a new chipset every 6 months, and no matter what, they had to have a product release. And so that drove a lot of the processes in the organization, priorities, if you like. So ultimately, culture is about what do we care about, and absolutely the person at the top can set that.
We'd like to think it's what do we care about that's of value to the customer. So is that part of the phrase? I mean, you could create.
That would be nice. I've worked in organizations where they've cared about things other than the customer.
Well, and that would be a good differentiation, right? If I've got a more customer-centric culture, then I've got an advantage.
Mm-hmm. So marketers talk about firms with market orientations. Entrepreneurship professors talk about firms with entrepreneurial orientations. Really, they're just talking about the sort of culture that those organizations have. I've worked in companies with an engineering culture, with an accounting culture, with a marketing culture, and you can almost smell it in the air as soon as you walk into those organizations what mm-hmm. the priorities are.
Yeah. So that brings us to the customer, Steve. And mm-hmm. can I think of my customer base as a resource? I know that firms prize their email lists and their Facebook followers, and there's mm-hmm. value seen in loyal and repeat customers. If that's a value that is marketable to acquirers and so on, mm-hmm. is building a base like that a customer base? Is that a resource?
It can be considered a resource. If we go back to the PROFIT acronym, R is for reputational assets or resources. And so if somebody, you have a whole bunch of likes on Facebook or Yelp or something like that, it's certainly going to help your company. It's signaling to others that this company can be trusted, that they deliver on what they say they're going to deliver on. So the more testimonials you have, the more independent reviews and sources and people saying good things about you, obviously that's going to boost your business. And that's something that's definitely under your control to manage and to build that over time. So accountants talk about goodwill in a business, but really that's what they're talking about, this ability to have a customer base of people that trust that business and the promises that they make, and they're willing to come back and work with them again and to have some sort of transaction. In that sense, it's something you can consciously build.
Do you think it's possible to do this reverse design process that we try to encourage, where you start with a customer and then you say, what resources are best attuned for me to deliver value to that customer? So I shape the culture, and I shape the resource set, and I shape the talent, and I shape the customer service, and I shape the technology, all in response to the customer. Is that realistic to do it in that direction?
I think you may have had a session before on effectuation, and I tend to be an effectual mm-hmm. thinker in that sense. And you can approach resources in the same way that you need to start with what you've got. And it's very easy to sit down and come up with the great master plan. If I had all the resources in the world, what would I do? But that's just not realistic for most entrepreneurs. And most people are going to start with a very finite set of resources under their control, whether tangible or intangible. And so I adopt this in my own work every day, but I'm always scanning to see what resources do I have available, what relationships can I make that may give me access to more resources, and then thinking about how I can stitch them together in a way that I think is going to add value in the marketplace. I find benchmarking is useful to see what others are doing, but then also to think about how can I take what others are doing and maybe to deliver something extra on top of that, you know. So, competitor A might be doing X and competitor B is doing Y. Well, why can't I do X and Y together? And then I'll differentiate myself from both of them, right? And what are the barriers to that? And what resources do I need to acquire in order to be able to do that? So it's a very iterative thing in my mind, very dynamic. Looking at what I currently control, and then as you expand your network and expand your opportunity set, new opportunities open up.
Right. That is the effectuation process, just for everyone's understanding who's listening. That's starting with the entrepreneur as opposed to the market problem to solve, I think, if that's a good summary. You say, who am I? What are my skills? What's my knowledge? Who do I know? What do I know? And what are my resources? And you start from there and then go out and apply those to the marketplace. Is that a controversial way to look at entrepreneurship, or is it well accepted these days, Steve?
I think it's the dominant theory right now of entrepreneurship among academics. It seems to have displaced the notion that entrepreneurs are seeking opportunities. It's seen very much more as an iterative process, and that people don't make long-range plans. They tend to adapt over time, if you like, sort of like a random walk, if you like, of which direction they end up heading. So if you ask somebody when they first founded their company what they thought they'd be doing 10 years later, you often find there's a very big discrepancy because they've seized opportunities as they've come along or taken resources that have come within their purview and used those to leverage other opportunities.
Yeah,
so it's not anti-market in any way. It's certainly thinking about how can I. It's just taking a more finite view of things rather than a wish list of resources I wish I had. It's taking the view of what can I do with what I've currently got in order to serve a niche or find something in the market that's valued.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, part of your reputational resource is that you're a practicing venture capitalist as well as a professor of economics. Mm-hmm. So you speak to the classroom and you author papers, but you also risk your own capital mm-hmm. in funding firms and entrepreneurs. So do you apply the principles we've been talking about today in your venture capital activities? And maybe you can share some examples of using RBV to analyze companies or coaching them or helping them.
Yeah, I absolutely apply this thinking. I'm always looking at a startup and thinking, as I mentioned earlier, what is their secret sauce? What are they bringing to the table that others are not bringing to the table, whether it's a relationship, whether it's intellectual property or patents? Typically, most people think that it has to be the intellectual property, but often that's not the case. I've seen cases of serial entrepreneurs that were funded who bring a track record that I just know how to organize startups to get a result, for example. And mm-hmm. the idea may not be a huge idea, but the confidence that there's going to be execution goes way up when you're dealing with a serial entrepreneur, for example. All of those factors play into thinking about who we're going to fund. Probably the biggest uncertainty these days is the notion of scaling. We have a lot of winner-take-all type markets, particularly in internet-related businesses. So there's only one Uber, one Facebook, one Google, and so forth. So typically a winner-take-most or winner-take-all market dynamics in play. So the big uncertainty right now is scaling organizations and whether companies have what it takes to grow quickly and suck in the resources they need in order to become that leader. So all of these things come into play when thinking about who we're going to support.
Have you ever seen a pitch deck that said, fund me because I've organized my resources really well?
I've seen pitch decks that say, fund me because I've done this before and I know what I'm doing. So
that's a good one.
That's certainly one way to get people's attention.
Yeah. What about the high street entrepreneur or the local entrepreneur, the business owner? We tend to talk a lot about startups, but there are folks in the landscaping business or the delivery business or furniture retailing. Can they use this resource-based view to help them sort out which resources and capabilities are going to help them more?
Yeah, I think they absolutely can. At the end of the day, I think where the world is moving is that you have to do everything in the value chain pretty well in terms of, you know, your operations and what you're providing and so forth. But it's always useful to have that little extra edge of why you. And so often it's as simple as location. You know, why do people come to my store and not somebody else's? It's because I'm closer to the customer base that I'm trying to serve, or I give better service, or any number of reasons. I have a special product that nobody else has. I do things in a different way, or I provide a little extra technology edge that others are not doing. So it's always useful to think about what am I going to be doing that others in this space are not doing in order to win that business. And that applies just as much to small businesses as to large businesses or gazelles or high growth businesses, if you like. Mm-hmm.
It's a nice way to look at it, I think, translating our search for uniqueness into the always asking the question, why me? Why choose me? Why should this customer choose me?
Mm-hmm.
And doing that every day because, as you say, it's dynamic and things change.
Yeah, and it's the same for universities. You know, I'm at Fayetteville State University right now in North Carolina, and we have a lot of universities in the space. And we just found out that some new ones were entering into the market. Competency-based education is becoming a thing with Western Governors University and Southern New Hampshire, both of whom have 90,000 students and operate nationwide. So it's an example of just change in our market and how we need to think of ways to adapt to that.
Right. Well, let's see if we can sum up at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We encourage the value-centric process, Steve, starting with the customer and their needs, although maybe the effectuation process is a little bit different, at least at its starting point. But the entrepreneur's goal is to assemble and, let's call it, polish these resources and tune them, combine them into a system that can deliver value. They're scarce. You know, I want to say unique, but let's stick with scarce.
Mm-hmm.
So the customer doesn't have alternatives that are better or even equally valuable to them, ideally. And we talked about some resource and some capabilities. So maybe you can sum that up in some way and then maybe point to some tools or processes or books or recommendations that our listeners can follow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one additional thing that Barney would point out that we haven't touched on is that you can have a competitive parity on resources. You can have the same resources that your competitors have, same resources and capabilities, or you can have an advantage or even a disadvantage in some areas. So it's always worth looking at the complete all aspects of your organization and benchmark against your competitors to say, what am I doing better? What am I not doing well? Mm-hmm. Where am I at parity? Because if you're doing one or two things better than your competitors, but you're also doing three or four things less efficiently, then you're not going to be making money and you're at risk of going out of business. So it's not enough just to think about how do we have an advantage, but also to think about how do we maintain parity or fix our weaknesses in a sense. So this harks back to the old SWOT analysis, right? And looking at your strengths and weaknesses, and Barney would say that's essentially what the resource-based view is doing a little bit.
Okay, I was going to ask you that specifically. So you think the SWOT tool is a useful exercise: strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats?
You got to be very careful with it. So typically when I've seen it applied across a range of organizations, it just becomes a shopping list of what people think is a strength and what they think is a weakness, and they really don't have any analytical insight into what makes something a strength or a weakness. And I think that's the real value of the resource-based view, is to say, no, something is a strength only if it's better than what your competitors are doing. You know, we're able to teach students at the university, but is that our advantage? Are we doing that better than our competitors? And what's our evidence for that? So certainly when I'm involved in strategic planning these days, I tend to beat people up about that, because it's so tempting just to pat yourself on the back and come up with a huge list of things you think you're good at, with no reference whatsoever to what everybody else is doing.
Well, presumably the metric for that is your customer, right? If the customer tells you you're doing better, then that's reasonably identified.
Well, I think the market share is a judgment by the customer, or your performance in the market, of the bundle of resources that you're deploying, right? So it doesn't tell you exactly which one of those is not firing on all cylinders. So in that sense, it's sort of removed from your delivery of value. So ultimately, as a manager and entrepreneur, you have to figure out why is our value delivery not on par with our competitor? Is it our distribution? Is our service? Is it our product quality? You know, what is it exactly that's letting us down, and why customers choose to buy from somebody else rather than us? And that's that's not necessarily something a customer is going to be able to tell you. They'll tell you that we don't want to buy from you, or we prefer somebody else, or we love what you're doing. But ultimately, it's a management task to figure out why is that happening.
Right. So you mentioned SWOT, and that's a tool. Is there any other processes, or maybe readings or books that our listeners can pick up?
One thing that I really like is The E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber. It's a classic. It's been around for a long time. But at the heart of what he's saying is, he's saying that most people start a business because they're good at something, whether it's baking cakes or mowing lawns or something like that, and they quickly get burned out on the business side of things. And his advice is for the entrepreneur to stop working in your business and start working on your business, and starting to think about how you create systems of value and how you create capabilities and organize what you're doing so it becomes a consistent, replicable system, if you like, of delivering value to your customers. So you can't just rely on yourself to be the only person that's doing it. So if you're in business because you're great at baking cakes, how do you make it so that every cake is produced by everyone you hire is going to be the same quality? And that way you can have the business grow and not just rely purely on your own personal unique value.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one very important book that I recommend to people.
Okay.
Scaling, as I've also mentioned, the importance of that, and Crossing the Chasm is a book that talks about how you go from a niche market to a mass market and how a lot of things have to change when you do that, and you have to develop all sorts of new capabilities in order to make that move. So it's not just a linear process, but there's actually some fundamental transformations that have to occur.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll provide links to those. Where does that PROFIT acronym come from? Is that in a book form or some other kind of form that people could access?
There was a book on entrepreneurship written from the resource-based perspective. I think I may have got it out of there, but I'll double check and I'll send you the link to the source.
Okay. We'll, as you say, we'll dig it out and we'll make it available to everybody. Well, Steve, thank you very much. That is a great exposition of the resource-based view. And I think a lot of the message is to do the analytics, to think carefully about the resources you've got, how they align with customer value creation, how they differentiate or don't compared to competition, and how they need to change over time. So it sounds like a continuous activity rather than a once in a while strategy review. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot that can be gained by just asking people, what can we do better? Where are we not working? You know, I had a graduation for MBA students a week and a half ago, and I went down the line of all the students and I said, tell me about the good, bad, and ugly about our program. What work, what doesn't work? And All of that provides intel to go back into those processes and capabilities and say, why is this happening? What can we do to improve it?
Yeah, one time we recommended a kind of formal way of collecting that information. We called it the voice of the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody told me, no, that's too formal. You just got to go out there and have the conversations and ask the questions. What's your point of view about that?
My experience is that, you know, you don't need to have a very large sample for people to figure out what's making people happy or not happy about your product. Where I find the disconnect is that everyone agrees that's a problem and then no one does anything about it. And so things like agile development, where you're looking at sprints and actually changing things and taking action, is actually, I think, the most important thing in this area. And that's something entrepreneurs do very well and large companies do not so well. And ultimately, that's going to keep entrepreneurs having an edge, I think, in many cases.
Right. So agile is not just a software development process. It's the way of running a nimble entrepreneurial company.
Yeah. So I'm a big believer in action and just fix it and do it. And it just amazes me how few people subscribe to that view and how few people actually do it.
Good. Well, Steve, thanks very much for coming and talking to us at Economics for Entrepreneurs. And we'll find another occasion to do this. We thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.